Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The following is a presentation of the Four Center podcast feed.
From the center of the galaxy, this is Four Center, a show about Star Wars pop culture in the ultimate adventure, life itself. An adventure I think we've all had a lot of this week. I'm Joseph Scrimshaw.
I'm Ken Knapsack.
And I'm Jennifer Landa.
And this is the Bad Batch Report. Well, that noise was easy to identify. That's the audience's soul, right, Ken, after watching this two-parter?
Absolutely. Some heartbreaking stuff we're going to get into, of course. But, man, I felt it in so many ways.
Yeah, these were a brutal couple of episodes. It hurt. Good, I guess we can talk about that. Anyway, we are doing our Bad Batch report here, talking about Season 3, Episode 10, Identity Crisis, directed by Saul Ruiz and written by Amanda Rose Munoz, and Season 3, Episode 11, Point of No Return, directed by Nate Villanueva and written once again by Amanda Rose Munoz. Story editor Matt Machenovitz is credited every episode this season. We are recording our Bad Batch report a little bit later. We had some schedule conflicts, and we always love being honest on Force Center. So we're just going to be honest that I think all three of us have had extremely busy weekends between life, other Star Wars work. So we are excited to be here and discuss Bad Batch. But if you sense any sort of, energy from us, I think we're all feeling a little beaten down, like our not as bad, hopefully, as our favorite characters from Bad Batch, but a little bit of honesty here for you as we record on this Monday morning. Ken, anything to add to that honesty?
I'm also, when I'm low energy, I maybe occasionally get grumpy. Now would be a great time to follow us on the social media platform of your choice. We announced that we were doing this episode late, and the amount of, hey, where's your review comments that came across. We announced it, and we also said it on the previous episode. So we're here. I had to travel, doing it in a hotel room, which I'm glad we didn't try, because even the I paid for the high internet hotel room, you know, join the our club and get high internet in the hotel, did not work. I had trouble watching these episodes. And we all had things to do. You know, again, it's life. This is the grind of the show. But anyways, yeah, I'm trying not to be grumpy. And then these episodes, when I finally, I also didn't watch them for 2 days. Mm-hmm. And trying to avoid social media spoilers is fine, because that's just natural. It wasn't like anyone was ruining it for me. But then, you know, people were tweeting us direct questions. I'm like, I haven't watched it. Calm down. I haven't watched it. All that to say, we're here. I'm here. Hi.
Yes. Yeah, I'm very excited to discuss. And Jennifer, you've been busy, I'm sure, with many life things, but we should also let people know that you released your big Jedi Beat episode about Carrie Fisher, the kind of big finale of your miniseries. For now, we can talk about more later. But you've been working hard on this Carrie Fisher episode, took a couple extra weeks to really get it right. How are you feeling now that it is released to the world?
I feel like I've just given birth. I am so tired, drained. I need a cranberry juice fruit cocktail like they give you in the hospital, in the maternity ward. Yeah, I was up till 5 this morning. So I don't have a brain right now. Yes. We'll stumble through this.
Yes, I understand. I think I'm going on about 8 hours sleep total since Thursday, maybe. Probably, that's a little bit of exaggeration. Maybe 12 to 16 hours. Yeah, juggling lots of different projects. And it was my wife had a dance performance that I was lucky to go and watch and be a part of. But that was it was a whole thing. And I watched these episodes on Tuesday night at midnight. So I've been sitting with them, the pain and the beauty, and waiting to process and discuss. So let's get into it from there. Jennifer, what was your overall emotional reaction? Did you like these episodes? Were you deeply affected by them? How did you react?
I loved the first of the two episodes. I cried and I was like, is it because I'm tired or because the story is so emotional? Whoever the performer was that played the Eva character, bravo, phenomenal. But yeah, that episode was fantastic. And the second episode was great too, just different type of vibe, obviously.
Yeah. Did you feel about the second episode that, did you feel like you were ahead of the show just because we've kind of known because of peaking, you know, Molly Damon in particular, you know, zeroed in, enhanced the frames and realized, yeah, I think Pabu's going to be attacked. Were you affected by feeling like that you knew where it was going?
Maybe that's what that was, because I was a little not quite as engaged, not quite as gripped, because you're right. I kind of was one step ahead. Yeah. But it was still great. A lot of action. And I was like, oh, is somebody going to die? Is it? No. Okay, good.
Yeah. Yeah. There was some high stakes for Wrecker and Gonky. Oh, yeah, terrible. I know. Ken, what was your big overall reaction to these two episodes?
Just the mood, the music, everything they accomplished and pulled off in both episodes, but particularly the first one, it was heartbreaking upon first viewing. And, you know, and it was also uplifting, because I think a lot of us weren't, I'm not alone here. We're like, I knew it. I knew Emery Carr had a heart. I knew there's something going to go there. And I liked all that. The second episode, yeah, you're right. I had a vibe of, this. Here we are. Here we are. We're at Pabu. We're losing Pabu in some way, shape, or form. And then, again, I want to say, I'm not mad at anyone. I get it. This is our job, so you would assume that I watch it early. I had several people tweet to me, hey, what do you think Omega was thinking when she was taking off the Tantus at the end of the episode? Like, so the episode started. I was like, well, I gotta kind of know where this is going. But again, that's life. I'm 2 days into viewing it. It's not on you. That's on me. But so second episode, my relationship with it was different. But it doesn't matter. It stands the test of time as a great episode. And episode 10 is, I think, one of my favorite episodes of Bad Batch.
Yeah, no. And Omega going to Tantus, not to rub salt in the wound, I think was the sort of surprise of the episode.
Yeah,
for me, because it was, yes, everything else was, it was great. And thematically, we'll talk about it a ton. It's not like I thought the episode was poor. It was just like we know this pain is coming. It's almost like a medical procedure that's like, you know, you have to do. I'm like, I'm not looking forward to this, but I should get that checked. And also Pabu will be invaded. Like, got to get through it. And Omega going back and the way she went back and her attitude was to me like the triumph and the surprise and the glimmer of hope in all the horror. Yeah, like all episodes of Bad Batch, but particularly really building through season two into season three, I think the triumph of it is a lot of it is the story, but it's also the execution that the animation, the performance, the music is all so designed to make you feel it. Just the beautiful rendering of actual twilight on Pabu, like the time of day on an ocean where there's like those beautiful shots of the island with the glittering lights of Community. And then that brief bit of glowing orange on the horizon as the sun goes down and all you're left with is the tormented blue clouds. Like, it's easy to just watch the episode and go, well, who is CX2? What's going to happen? Blah, blah, blah. But it's the power of the images in the way it's done that makes you feel it. And oh, it's twilight on Pabu. both these episodes did all those great moments of just the way the story was told is brutal and makes you feel it.
I agree. The second viewing I was able to watch quickly this morning before recording on my normal size TV. The first viewing was on my cell phone in a hotel while rain and wind pounds against the window. There was a moment where CX2 is about to do something dastardly, but I was like, oh, look how beautiful that was. I'd hang that on a wall and he's about to blow up the Marauder, but that's wonderful.
Yeah. Right. Beautiful, beautiful horror. And I think a couple of other big picture observations, then we can get into the details of the themes. We've often discussed Bad Batch as a sort of tour of this early Imperial era. And I think timeline wise, it's getting later and later.
Yeah.
It was affecting to me right away that first scene in the first episode that we Star Wars fans have known that it's not safe to be a little baby with the Force in this era. I don't know if we've ever just seen the scene of a totally unconnected to any lore, unconnected to any other character. We've seen many a Padawan run during Order 66. But I think maybe this is the first time that we've really got to viscerally see in live action. It's just a baby with the Force being turned in. You know, it really, over the years, there's always been that discussion of how did everybody forget about Jedi in 19 years between the trilogies? And I think that a lot of fans have discussed, like, it's not so much that people forgot the Jedi, is that do not speak of them. Do not think about them under pain of horror. And it was really powerful to see that literal conversation of like, that kid's cursed, gifted, if you know what I mean, was really powerful to me.
It's absolutely going to be in our theme conversation. And Jen, definitely want your perspective on this one to kind of maybe end this swing through this part of the story before we dive in. But it was one of my favorite scenes for a lot of the reasons you're talking about, Joseph. Until this moment, it's a trivia answer, right? Mm-hmm. It's a, well, you know what Palpatine did. He took it. You know what Cad Bane did a lot. And it's almost a fun Star Wars lore answer to see it and feel it on this level. I was going through some personal, one of the last things that happened before I traveled is my little dog, Franny, like came out and was panicked that I was leaving at 3 a.m. and barked and cried. And then if it had been a Rodian family that had opened that scene, but it was the most pet like looking cute face mom and kid that I was just like, I didn't want to leave my chihuahua. Like, what is my chihuahua going to do without me? And I just was like, the whole scene, but all that comedy aside is exactly what you're describing, Joseph. It was, hey, that little wrinkle of Star Wars storyline, we're going to make you feel it and understand how horrible it was.
Yeah, truly. The tour of the Imperial era of like, it's awful. And you see that in lots of ways. Last big picture thing I'll say is I do think these two episodes are a triumph for toy lovers. There's lots of stuff about how great toys are and how important. So I felt validated. all right, let's get into some of the big picture ideas, the big themes. I want to throw this out there to both of you. I think there's a lot of different ways to look at it. These episodes are obviously about vulnerability and people trotting on the innocent. But I thought what really connected them was this idea of the strength it takes to be a protector of others. Like we look at these episodes and we see these things that we value of home and family and community, and they're being trampled by the Empire in lots and lots of different ways. But if you put the episodes together, they're studying in the contrast, or maybe growing together, of Emery and Omega. The first episode is really all about Emery struggling to be there for the innocent, for children, to protect them. And the big finale of this quiet, haunting episode is Emery making a massive emotional and heroic breakthrough by giving a child a small handmade toy and moving herself closer to Omega. In the second episode, there's a lot that I want to talk about of Omega's growth and Omega truly becoming an adult. But Omega's so far down the journey from what we just saw with Emery, of Omega has no doubt that she must protect and rescue the innocent, that she has to be there for the people of Pabu, that she has to be there for all of her clone family on Tantus. You know, that great scene with Crosshair where she's really saying, like, I have to give myself over. I have to sacrifice myself for now. I can't let the people here suffer more because of me. We've been looking for a way to find our brothers. There's all sorts of stuff going on in both episodes. But to me, when I was really trying to boil it down, it was the first episode is Emery struggling to decide if she can and should be there for the children, if she has the bravery to be there for the children, and Omega having no doubt that it is her job. It is a human's job to be there for the community. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, does that make sense to you? And if so, how do you feel about it?
I like that. I saw it that the children are really the ones helping the adults in both episodes. It's the kids who are stirring this and kind of awakening for Emery, her empathy and, you know, willingness to connect. And obviously with Crosshair and Omega, she's like, no, I can do this. I'm okay. Like, sorry, Dad, I gotta go do this, right? Yeah. It's time for me to leave and fulfill this part of the mission. And I thought that is really great. And it's great for kids to be able to see that hey, they're the ones that are making this change and they're the ones that have the power in both episodes.
I think that's a really great way to look at it. Yeah, because I think I was really looking at it of these sort of internal realities of Emery and Omega. But you're right that what's pushing them to make those choices is the children, and Omega being the child on the way to adulthood.
Being
more of an adult than Crosshair, I think, of like, mm-hmm. some great stuff there. I love her line about think of the bigger mission, because Crosshair has been on this journey to become closer to Omega. And she's basically saying, like, it can't just be about me. You've learned to care about me, but now you need to care about everybody, all the clones, all the people on Pabu. I'm only a part of it. It's great that you've had this emotional awakening, Crosshair, but it can't be just only about me. You can't love me and still just be an a-hole to the entire rest of the galaxy. That's not going to work. Ken, how do you feel about these big picture ideas of the children leading the way to the adults making a better choice?
It's the center of Star Wars. It's the center of our discussions. Look to the next generations and look what they can give back to you and look where they're leading and follow it. And that includes just the Star Wars fandom itself. Even on my trip this weekend, dealt with some warm, wonderful folks who just have this new Star Wars sucks, right? Kind of vibe, and that might be more your opinion, but look beyond it. Look to the people coming behind you. Look at the ones who this is their stories, and there should be your stories as well, I think, if you find a way to engage with them. And I think a lot of that's present with what you're talking about, Jen, and the children. The children are their future. Teach them well. Let them lead the way, as we've said before, even here. And just what you're talking about, too. Yeah, I think it was almost the benefit of maybe having an idea of what was going to happen at the end of the second episode with Omega, mm-hmm. watching Emery go through what she's going through and thinking, when they meet up again, well, that's going to be an entirely different vibe and even more important. And what is Omega going to give to Emery? What is she going to teach Emery? Where's Emery going to be at the end of this episode 10? I hadn't even finished the episode yet, but I was thinking about them. They're obviously connected. And it was this, again, a trivia question or an answer of lore that's forthcoming. What's the connection when season 2 ends? Emery and Omega and sister, you know, clone, whatever it might be. And it's going beyond that to something more important. And there, the, to in, in conjunction with your themes, and we talk about this tour of the Empire during this era, I really think this episode titled Identity Crisis deals with how much, how many people have to hide and suppress who they are, and how those around them can't even let them live their lives out loud and in the public. And your identity must be suppressed. That's part of the suppression. This is a Boot of the Empire episode. The idea, the image of the Empire showing up on Pabu was one of those oppressive boot moments we've talked about before here. And that leading to this big thing with Emery, I was really drawn to how they played it out of I looked at kind of discovering the core of the path you're on and analyzing your choices and maybe who you thought you were, that being part of the identity crisis that sometimes happens. I think Emery is as a product of her environment. She might be a product of science in a way. You know, she was bored and put in this world to be something, and she's on the imperial path and not question anything. We saw she's just a great worker. At the beginning of the episode, she's kind of summarizing what we've seen before. I'm pretty good at this. Why don't I do it? And then the truth of who she's associated with, the truth of the path she's on, is leading her to a great change in this triumphant moment of a toy, as you so well said. So, yeah, loved all that there. A lot to dive into, even more.
Yeah, and I think there's been this big question of who Emery is in terms of, like you're saying, yeah, lore of what's her backstory, which we got a little hint of. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, beat at the end of season two of I'm Your Sister, and it's a little been soft played of what does that mean? How is that going to play out? And I think it was great to spend quality time with her, but also see Jennifer, to your point of the children leading the way, that it is Omega's victory of getting through to Emery. I love that the show took the time for Emery to be doing her science and to look through her data pad and look at that picture of Omega. And like when I'm first watching it, I'm kind of thinking like, is she going to have some epiphany about the science of it? But I love that it was just a total emotional moment of just looking at this picture of Omega and remembering how much Omega fought for that little bit of humanity. Mm. That's what gives Emery the idea to give the toy. So it is Omega instructing Emery, to your point, which I think is great. But another key quote that I really thought was powerful in these episodes was Emery saying to Nalasay says, you need to watch after the specimens, the children now. And Emery saying, there's nothing I can do. I don't have that kind of power. And Nalasay says, don't you? And we can talk if that's like a, oh, is she force sensitive too? And all that. But I felt like, to me, the emotional impact of it was this classic Star Wars idea of we all have a choice always. And even if you can't go running out and, you know, I don't think that Emery does have the power to go hit the big red button on Mount Tantus that says, blow it up, end it, stop everything. Right. She probably doesn't have the power to just stop everything. But she has this little human power of symbolically and literally treating the specimens as humans, as children. Jennifer, how do you feel about that idea that maybe you can't defeat the entire system of horror, but we always have the power to have a little humanity within that system, and maybe that can make a difference?
That's what I was so impressed by with this episode, was considering that this is animated and, you know, a certain amount of time that we get to spend with these characters. And they just let her kind of come to this realization slowly. It was how any of us might react in that situation. If we were in that situation, like, hey, they're kids. We don't have to be so cold. It was just like kind of peppered in a very natural and organic way so that it doesn't feel like ham-handed when she finally does give the doll, right? Mm-hmm. I thought that was just so well done. And it made me, I don't want to say identify, but it just felt a little bit more relatable to her journey. And it's like, oh, I knew it. I knew she wasn't all bad. And that's what I think is so great about this show, is that they're not dealing with black and white, right? Like good guys, bad guys. It's really like this gradient of I don't want to say gray, but you know what I mean? Like seeing different colors within these characters, that they're not all bad. She's in a bad situation, but she does have the power to make a difference.
Yeah. To have the empathy to see that she is trapped in a massive system. Mm-hmm. And also just in a very short, elegant way that I'd love to talk about, we get a little sense of maybe what happened to her, which I think also gives her some empathy. So she's talking to Nala Se, and saying, "They're children, like I was. Was your plan to discard them too?" That for me was like I've been waiting for a little hint of how did Emery end up where she is in sort of buying into the just be a good worker bee, show everyone how skilled you are at science. And that's the way to acceptance. Ken, how did you feel about that little hint of backstory for her, both emotionally and from a honestly like storytelling, like who is she? What's the story perspective?
Yeah, it makes sense there, too. There's so many wonderful mysteries to explore and the ghosts of Camino that we'll get to. but how it tied into the episode. And I'll say that the you know, I'll say humanity, but species manity whatever, in the galaxy. But humanity, for lack of a better term, like the victory of this episode was preserving a little bit of the identity of these quote unquote specimens. That was the big choice, because that might not have been what she got, or maybe she felt she couldn't. And again, she gets thrown into this cog. How the details still forthcoming, but she's thrown into a cog. You're right. She can't press the destruct button. There is no big red in this all situation. And the conversation spoke to me, too, of that you put it down. There's nothing I can do. I don't have that kind of power. But the question before that is, what will you do, Emery? And what a big Star Wars question. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what will you do? And this the victory being this little sliver of, again, what I'll say, humanity for the specimens, for their soul, a little bit of I will acknowledge that you are more than a number. And that is the victory today. That is the spark that will light the rebellion. That is the kind of thing that Star Wars hits on time and time again. And to tie it back to, again, what might be her beginning, how she feels, and it probably is correct. I've tossed aside, you know, tossed aside.
I liked it because it gave me empathy for her of like she was just, you know, put in this, given to the emperor or empire rather by the Kaminoans, it would seem like with was I discarded too, some deal of like, man, look at our clones have lots of value. We're working on a new model. maybe they're smarter than the boys. Take a scientist clone. It gave me a lot of, you know, empathy for Emery and understanding, you know, sort of that pain often does lead to maybe not making great decisions or not questioning the systems you're trapped in, but also made me think that there is growth with Nala Se. If Nala Se was all in, taking the money from the Empire, handed over Emery, and I know different people have different amounts of different opinions about this, but I think there's this great contrast where Hemlock is certain that Nala Se has been protecting Omega because she's has scientific value, and I have feel like the storytelling is Nala Se is aware that Omega will become a target because of her scientific value, that Omega's value to Nala Se has become personal, which to me sort of implies emotional growth from Nala Se that maybe she did discard Emery years back, but she doesn't want to discard Omega and she wants to protect the kids there. Jennifer, how do you feel about Emery's backstory and all that?
I thought it was really well done, because then it makes all of her choices prior to this episode make sense. It's why we see those little flickers of empathy, or even like her ability to connect to Omega. It's like, oh, that's why. And then really seeing these kids in this situation, it was really upsetting. And it's so fascinating, because we know that the Jedi took kids, right? And we've always been like, oh, I've always wondered, well, what's that like? And do they miss their families? And here was the exact opposite. And it was as horrifying as I would imagine when she says, when am I going home? I want to go home. Oh my gosh. And just seeing them like looking so sad. Oh my, the animators, they really did an incredible job. Yeah.
There was one shot of Eva, where she was kind of playing, but was really bored by the game and listless, and her little legs were kicking. And it was just like the animators went and like, let's add 10% more to the sadness filter. Let's just kick that up several more
details.
Notches.
Yes, details. Oh, yeah. My gosh.
I did also like, I think, once I really thought about both episodes as these sort of choices to help and protect others, that there's so much of protecting others laced throughout that second episode with without thinking. We don't get much Wrecker, but Wrecker jokes with Gonki about leaving him behind. And as soon as he sees an explosion, grabs Gonki. Gonki has value. He's part of the squad. Without question, there's protection from Wrecker. We got Batcher, like, running in because he has to protect families. All of our heroes, you know, obviously the main characters are doing everything they can to protect Omega and protect Pabu. There's, in contrast to the horror and the sadness of that first episode, there's so much of protecting others in the second episode. How did that hit you, Ken?
I love how you broke it down there. I think it absolutely is present. And these episodes are two wonderful bookends. No wonder they connected them. It makes sense. And it always does. Every time there's a two-parter, you're like, oh, okay. That's why I had extra time to watch. That's why I had to make extra time to watch two episodes this week. It works so well together. I absolutely think it's present. It was the Wrecker saving Gonki moment was absolutely one of my favorite things for a lot of reasons. But you see everyone needing to save, trying to save. The questions about how do you save, what really saves, I think that comes down to the Omega Crosshair thing. And Crosshair's, you know, still on a journey. But, you know, you got Hunter trying, even in failing. There's just a lot of great efforts to preserve, save, protect. Even the idea of we'll shed a tear, the tech goggles. Is about preserving and saving memories and legacy and on those kind of levels.
Yeah, no, absolutely powerful. Jennifer, did you feel heartened at all amidst the horror by all our heroes in Pabu trying to protect one another, or were you just awash in horror?
I was like, don't kill my Gonki. Don't kill my Batcher. You better keep Wrecker alive. This is not his time to go. Like, I was just getting on the edge of my seat wondering, is this going to be? Because, you know, that's the thing with Bad Batch. You don't know. When they took out my tech, I was like, well, anything and anyone is fair game. This show is not afraid to ramp it up and make us feel emotional and miss our heroes. So, yeah, I loved it. And I also was terrified at what was going to happen.
It gave it a lot of great, great tension to feel like, I don't think, this doesn't seem like a big enough moment for Wrecker, but like, when he came out, I kind of expected him to, like, you know, shake it off and go, oh, man, he's out. So great. Watching Omega be stripped of her protectors and, you know. Another thing I wanted to talk about was in both of these episodes, I feel like we spend a lot of time with the villains and we get a little bit of villain perspective, not even from an empathy perspective. I don't mean it that way. There's a lot of just plot mechanics. But I was really affected by how much we were seeing what is motivating the bad guys. And I think it's kind of classic Star Wars stuff. But these are both episodes about, you know, innocents, families, children's community being brutalized. So it made me think about the why. And a lot of the villains did have like a little moment where you're reminded that it's greed. It's a lust for power. It's ego. It was a little trip of why this brutalization is happening and dehumanization. Cad Bane, you know, is put across as one, you know, the baddest bounty hunter of this era. And in Clone Wars, we've seen him do like impressive things. He fights off Kenobi and Quinlan Voss. There's kind of this thing in this episode, in this arc, where he's, you know, a class one bounty hunter. Only class ones can go after these incredibly sensitive targets. And he's got the Emery asks him how many, you know, specimens he's got. And he's just like, let's just say I'm good at my job. And then you watch what he did. Like, oh, big man, you stunned a defenseless parent at their door and kidnapped a baby. Big effing man. I was really affected by seeing how much his ego is caught up in the big jobs, but there was nothing to be proud of. It was just empty ego. Ken, did you have any Cad Bane thoughts or reactions?
I loved the use of him here because I thought it was, in the end, all I might need from him in this season. There's thoughts of, you know, Do we get him and Boba? There's still a Boba factor that hangs over some of this show for me, meaning I'm just curious. Is there ever going to be a time where the idea of Omega and Boba Fett and Emery, are we ever going to have more with that? I don't know. Might not be this show. I don't know if it's needed as much anymore where they're gone with the season because of the stuff with Cad Bane. Yeah, he is fear-inducing. We've seen that both now in live-action animation, but... what is he actually doing? I love that. Yeah, yeah. You didn't even pick up the baby. You bullied your droid into doing it, too.
He did next to nothing. Next to nothing. But we also get the shot of the Aqualish getting the credits kind of thrown at him by Cad Bane and being really reminded that this cruelty is for a small amount of money.
Yeah.
Cad Bane motivated by money and ego. We get that Tarkin scene, which is just, I think, about political machinations and moving the plot forward and hinting at maybe this is why Project Necromancer falls apart as well, because Tarkin's not on board. But I also felt like it was great to spend a little bit of time again with Hemlock and remember that for him, this is all about ego. He wants to please the Emperor. He wants to take over all of the Imperial Science Division, and he's jockeying for position, you know, with Tarkin was a reminder that that's what this is about for him, is ego and power and station. There's the little reminder for CX2 that he is being led around by the nose about ego too. Hemlock manipulates him by saying, like, you know, do you need the other troops I'm working on aren't ready to help you. And CX2 is like, I can handle it on my own. And Hemlock says, can you? You've already failed once. So there's a lot of that. Like, none of these villains are, they're doing it because they're twirling their mustaches and have black capes like in a British panto. They're all in this classic Star Wars way, so sadly motivated by greed and ego and jockeying for position within their society. Ken, how do you feel about being reminded that they're not just doing it because they're bad, but that they all have these human motivations that we are all susceptible to for the horrific things they're doing in these episodes?
Well, yeah, Jen, you said, you know, we got this gradient. Gray is a term often, not even misused. It's just, I don't know. It's a third category that I don't think exists. I think it's often the journey between the dark and the light, the good and the bad. Your choices in the end do put you on a side. And there's, I think, two choices there. With Star Wars, it's light and dark. But the journey there is based on things like you're talking about, Joseph. It is this fear. It's Krennic going, I need to be three rows up in the meeting. It is I can do it. I just rewatched Barbie on the plate. It is the, you are not just your accomplishments. You're more than that. You could be Knuff too, CX2, if you just pay attention. When you got
might
it.
Be eventually. Yeah.
Yeah.
You are Tech Knuff. Yeah.
Yeah. You were Tech Knuff. You were Tech Knuff. And that's very human things. How many times have we said over the years, I know it's one of my favorite moments. That's why I mentioned a lot of just this revelation that we got, was it during Alphabet Squadron, that you know, the Emperor himself was tracking so many things, because if you lied on an invoice, he wanted you on his team because you had some moral gray area that was going to allow him to push you towards a decision that would benefit him and his side. So the gradient, as Jed, you coined this phrase for us now, the gradient is where we're living, and it is stuff like this where even the big bad bounty hunters or the guy who spied and reported this for you, Force sensitive kid. Oh, big man there. And you're hiding while Cad Bane throws some cash at you. You couldn't even come out. Yeah, it's all
yeah. Big Aqualish. Jennifer, how did you feel about seeing those very sadly relatable human emotions behind all the horror?
I just want to say that I loved how they used the cameos. I don't want to say cameos, but characters that we already know, because I think we knew that Cad Bane was going to be here, right? I can't remember. When he appeared, I was like, that's right. Yeah, I was like, oh, that's right. He's here. He was used so well. And it was a different side of him. I don't want to say a different side. It was a different look to him in that he seemed bored. He seemed like he was not fulfilled. It was his body posture. while his droid was going and doing the deal and everything, he was like on that, you know, little machine, like fiddling with it.
He was just checking Instagram.
That's what it looked like. This is what it looked like. He wasn't even engaged.
Is there any bounties that aren't babies? Any non-baby bounties for me to prove myself?
You know, it's like when you're in a rideshare car, the driver's getting other rides where you enter. You're like, hey, I'm here. Talk to me.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, he was so cold and it was so cruel. And it was just, and then when he like throws the money, I was like, oh, he is horrible. He's a horrible, like, I don't know. I guess I kind of liked him before. Now I really don't like him. Yeah. He has been pushed to the bad. Like you said, Ken, that is a great, great way to put it. Cause eventually they do have to choose a side.
It was interesting to get a little bit more perspective from him in Book of Boba Fett, where he is priding himself on, he's one of the kind of these kind of classic, like, there isn't hope in the world. Everyone is brutal. And if that is the reality, if you're a sucker to believe in hope and community, it's just everybody is out for number one, then there's nothing wrong about being the best at being out for number one. And he so wants Boba Fett to admit that that's the truth of the world and that that's who Boba Fett is. In a lot of ways, that's like the most perspective we get from Cad Bane. And it seems like that is here in this episode too. If he's just like, kind of boring to just, you know, kidnap babies. I used to break into the Jedi Temple and steal holocrons. Yeah. You know, kind of boring. But there's still this pride to me in that I see the galaxy the way it is everybody's out for number one. And he gives that little poke to Emery of like, you reveal a lot more than you think asking questions like that.
Yeah.
Like he thinks he's so much better than her because he's so good at being cold and distant in number one.
Yeah.
Sad.
As if to say, you know, how, you know, you keep asking questions like that, people are going to think you have a heart and you care. You have hope and you're connected.
Yeah. Yeah. Stop that. I also thought there was a nice, nice is the wrong word. There was very clear stuff in that first episode about terminology. Lots of, you know, very traditional Star Wars, you know, mechanical versus the flowing inorganic of they don't have names. Don't hang out with them. They're numbers. There's a lot of they're not children. They are specimens. They're scientific assets. On Pabu, CX2 keeps using the term fugitive for Omega. And that was also, I think, well done in sad, because I think it is a very real world thing of if you are perpetrating cruelty. If you label everybody else with, you know, a different label than human, or they're the Omega's a fugitive. So what I'm doing is just justice. And what you're doing, harboring her on this island, is criminality. That that need to dehumanize your targets so you're not the one doing the cruel thing was really evident in these episodes and sad. Anybody want to talk about that?
There was an agency I used to work with pretty closely. They have guns and badges, and there's a famous, infamous saying called NHI, and it is called No Humans Involved, and it would be said at crime scenes. You joke because it's just that's how it was. I think there's some truth in that.
Yeah, it's really hard. Anything you want to talk about with that, Jennifer, or should we move on?
Make it light and fluffy, Jen. Make it light and fluffy.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm sorry. I don't have little toys to make it better right now. Here, take toys.
I know. I need my Tuca doll. No, I don't. Wow. I'm going to marinate on that for a while.
Yeah. Well, to bring it up a notch, I want to talk quickly about the loss of home and comfort.
Lighter.
Yeah, you know. The toys were really humanizing, but I did like the focus on we're seeing all this cruelty, but we need to be reminded of what is essentially valuable to beings, to humans, to community, which is this idea of home. The kids talk about wanting to go home. Omega mentions that Pabu is the only place that ever felt like home. Their ship, the Havoc Marauder, being destroyed, they didn't linger on it. But the show has really positioned the Havoc Marauder as home to Omega. So she lost two homes this episode in Pabu in that ship. So there's all this stuff about home being the goal and the tragedy being the loss of it. And there's also, I think, obviously a lot of great stuff with the value of toys the little guy, the baby, Baron's toy. is, you know, the catalyst for all of this. The victory is Omega's makeshift Lula. Her leaving, Omega being willing to leave behind the original Lula that started out, if I remember correctly, as Wrecker's toy that made their cold barracks on Kamino feel like home. And there's some stuff early on where Wrecker's kind of like, yeah, it's just our barracks in a science, you know, installation, but it was our home and we wrote our, you know, victories on the wall and we had Lula. So Lula's always been this symbol of home. Ken, how did you feel about what the episodes had to say about home, comfort, toys, the things that make us human?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm glad I didn't buy a Murado Lego set and start to build it like I did the Razor Crest studio I bought the weekend. And I know you contributed to the bigger campaign for the Razor Crest, and then we all watched it die.
I'm just not getting attached to ships in modern Star Wars. As soon as they introduce me to a cool ship, I'm going to be like, well, bye.
Well, it's big. And look, you could rebuild anything in Star Wars. Sure, there could be the Marauder too, whatever. But like, I had a little bit of a, oh my God. And a lot of it is how it's been framed. You're absolutely right. It is a traveling home. It takes her to Babu. There's so much to happen on there. Going back to the beginning of this series, it was when they walked into their barracks in like the pilot episode of this, it had a sitcom vibe. Like I was like, oh, this is going to be one of the six locations on the sitcom that we're always going to go to. Right. The Cheers back room, Sam's office here. Yeah. And it is about, finding those things that are you. I think that's, if you're a fan like us, and no matter when you started loving Star Wars, that part of it is the collecting, part of it is the toys, and you can make fun of it. It can be jokes, and yes, folks like Joseph and I can be battling kids in a toy aisle for Star Wars figures, and we always let them win. But that's who you are. It represents you. It's so powerful because it's something on a shelf that says, "That's me. This is a part of me." And that's part of what makes things home. But that's why we put pictures up. That's why we have, you know, that couch you love, all those things. I love the way it's played out in this show time and time again. And these little tiny things mean so much. The humanity, the speciesmanity of it.
Yeah. How did you feel, Jennifer, about, the episodes focusing on home and how much toys were such an important through line?
I loved it because with babies, you know, one of the things that they recommend is you give them a lovey, like a little toy attached to a little blanket. And it's to basically provide comfort and to soothe, help the baby when you are the mom or dad is away, right? So seeing the toys used to bring comfort and then Omega finally feeling like she's now at the age, which happens with a lot of kids, right? They're like, no, I'm okay. I don't need my little lovey anymore. I'm going to leave it here. But also that she finally feels comfortable enough to put down roots in some sense, right? Like she's like, this is Pabu's going to be my home, whatever. So I just thought that was so beautiful. And I just want to say, speaking of toys, the little baby, I don't know what, is it Baron? You called him Baron?
Baron, B-A-Y-E-R-N, I believe. Yeah.
Baron, he was making all those cooing sounds. And one of the sounds was a sound that a Grogu toy that I have makes. It's a little Grogu toy. And I was like, that's the sound that I have that toy. And I just love that they incorporated that detail into his little coos. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was so great and so relatable. Like, I think I got a lot of comfort as a kid from toys. And I think I have like powerful memories of what you're describing. I'm sure a lot of people do. But I remember I still like stuffed animals as even by like second and third grade, I already had the hard asses on the playground. Like, I don't need stuffed animals anymore. And I was quietly like, I do, I want them. And I'm sure that it's a part of the psychology that has led me to be a toy collector and want to advocate for the symbolic power of them and all that. So that relationship being presented in such a powerful way was affecting to me. And I love what you're saying about Omega growing and saying, I don't need Lula, but also respecting the sort of the symbolic power of that doll it was Wrecker's. Wrecker gave it to me. I needed something like it. So I made a makeshift version of it. She doesn't even know that makeshift version of it is now giving comfort to another child. And that kindness and that comfort is being passed on and on. I love that she wasn't just like the Star Wars version of, I don't need Lula. Kill her at the garage sale, right? It was,
right.
I'm going to leave Lula here among the treasures of Pabu, because that's how important she is. I can get by without her, but I don't for a second diminish her incredible importance and value. That was really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, well said. Yeah. The connection from the moment with Emery to that. Yeah. It's strong.
I love it. Yeah. Absolutely. Great stuff. A final little thing I want to talk about is we've kind of been tracking throughout the, this season of, the kind of the twilight of the Bad Batch of, you know, Omega really growing into an adult, and Wrecker, Hunter, and Crosshair kind of slowing down in lots of different ways. And just not racking up a lot of wins, really. Mm. And they're slowly stripped away in this episode. Wrecker is knocked out by the explosion. Hunter fails in doing the cool, steal the ship. Crosshair, we got to talk about that shot. That's an all-time shot of that tracker missing the ship. That is that setting up Omega's journey. Mm-hmm. I think it is about sort of like the truth that we all fade a bit in our abilities as we age, like that tracker missing. I know the ship is taken off and all that, but it is like, that's the older generation slowing down. That one shot. Ken, were you expecting Crosshair to make the shot?
Yeah, I was.
By the thing falling into the ocean?
I think as it fell, I think I wasn't shocked as so much as just kind of reminded, even on an emotional surface level, what you're talking about on a deeper level of that we all fade away. it all happens. Hell, I was at if not the last inning of Dodger great Oral Hershiser's career. He was like 41. He started a game. And I think he got two outs, and he proceeded to hit like two or three batters and couldn't get the ball 50 feet. And an entire stadium went, oh my God, it's done. It's done. And I think that's the reality of life. And to have Crosshair, I'm saying it as a comedy beat, but it's just like, there has to be another way to do this right now. And it can't just be my strength, my skills. I'm a good soldier. I follow orders and I'm the best of the best of the best, the best. That ain't what it is anymore. And you're going to have to find another way. You're going to find other people. And that's part of, we talk about change. We talk about generational change. That's at play in Star Wars a lot.
Yeah. And involve and use different skills. And yeah, it is powerful. How did you feel about that shot, Jennifer? Did you expect Crosshair to make the shot with the tracker?
I did. And I think that's what made me so uneasy. The entire episode was kind of seeing all of our heroes, which I was like, oh, of course they're going to get out of this situation. It's not going to be a problem, but they are fading. And it just was like a reminder, especially with Omega's conversation with Crosshair. It's very much like as we get older with our parents or our caregivers, and they just, they're losing it, or they can't do the things that they used to do. And for me personally, is like, you look to that person as like you're, you know, steering the ship, right? Steering the family. And now suddenly I have to say, you know, parent, step aside. I'm going to steer the ship. I know what's best. And let me tell you, parents don't like to hear that even in their older age, but at some point that has to happen. And so seeing Omega doing the right thing and finally saying, look, let me take over. That was really powerful.
It was really powerful. And I didn't feel like Crosshair let her down. Right. It was that like he fought off the troopers. He did a great job. The ship, you know, it wasn't that he missed the shot, right? The ship just started to leave and he was a second too late. Right. So, we're talking about this sort of diminishment. It isn't like he's just like, she trusted him and he goofed it. Because he's
right. Exactly. You know, right. Right. It's subtle. Like, it's subtle.
You know, I love that it just felt like she was like, this is the best plan we got. It's not perfect. We don't have time for another one, but we can't do nothing. Let's go. There was no sense to me of Crosshair letting her down. It was just like, that didn't work. We'll find another way. Which I want to ask you both about the final moment. Omega's on the ship. She takes that deep calming breath. People tweeted us questions about it. accidentally telling Ken how the episode ends. It happens. I think I can sometimes be dangerously optimistic and cling to the hopeful moments. But I found such hope and power in that moment, because I think after watching, you know, an hour of children in communities in the innocent be brutalized, to see this image of Omega definitely in danger, definitely not in full control, but emotionally entirely in control. And what I was left with is almost fist pumping at the idea of the last time she went to Tantis, she was a child and a prisoner. And now she is going on purpose as a liberator. It's it's overstating to say it's her choice to go, because all these forces were there to take her. But she has her head so screwed on straight of, I need to do this to save Pabu. I need to do this to potentially save all the clones there. I know the situation I'm going into, and I know what I need to do. And that breath, whether it's connecting with the Force or whether it's just this deep breath of, life's not easy, it's not perfect, I have a really hard thing to do in front of me, but I'm just going to take a deep breath and I'm going to absolutely do my best in this bad situation. If it's the Force or if it's just a young girl collecting herself for a hard task ahead, it was an incredibly powerful deep breath to me. Jennifer, how did you feel about that moment?
I loved it. At first, I did think, I was like, oh, they're connecting with the Force. But it almost felt like a sigh, like a relief. Like, finally, she's been running. Everyone's been trying to protect her. And she's finally like, no, now is the time. I'm ready. I am at peace with this decision I've made. And I was like, wow, she's grown up so much, grown up before our eyes. And it's going to be terrifying. But she is mentally prepared. A wonderful reminder for me. Take that breath. Collect yourself before doing something hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Ken, what did you feel about that moment?
Yeah, we could get the answer of whether or not she's force sensitive, all this stuff. I thought we got a little bit more of an explanation of why they, you know, her blood being a binder for M counts, all that kind of stuff soon come. I definitely didn't take it as force related at all, but I can see, like, Jen, how you would feel that in the moment. It's a very, we've seen Jedi do that before, right? but I think it is connecting. It's a both feet on the ground. It is put your feet on the ground and be present in this moment. This is where we're at. That does not mean it's bravery, it's courage, but it doesn't mean she doesn't have fear, doesn't have doubts. All those things, of course, we know are still present. But it's not like, wasn't like a resignation, but it was just like, yeah, this is what I needed to do. Because remember, she's been wanting to turn back from the start of the season. Like, I only got Batcher and I only got Crosshair. That's not enough. It's not enough. I want to go back. And whether or not she feels it's going to be successful or not, she knows she has to be here. She wants to be here. She needs to be here. And I think that's what I took the breath at. It doesn't mean, you know, doesn't mean you're not afraid. Absolutely not. We all have fear. That's the thing. Everyone has fear. This episode shows a lot of fears that we discussed earlier. What do you choose to do with that fear? I think is how you move forward best on this path towards the light, away from the dark. And she's doing it. And I love the breath. I love the moment. I think you're right, Joseph, to have hope for hope.
Awesome. I feel validated. And I think to me, what was powerful about it as well is, yeah, I think she might be force sensitive, and I think we might move up to some, you know, amazing moment where she pushes a button from across the room and it saves the day, you know, with the force kind of thing. Maybe. But it is Jedi stuff, because she learned it from a Jedi. She learned it from Gungi. And it was one of those moments where I love the fantasy of Star Wars, and I love that the story is the Jedi have literal power. They're space wizards. But it's also just a reminder that the power of being a Jedi is the philosophy. And for a young girl to be able to say, maybe I can move things with my mind, but what matters right now is I was taught this philosophy of be sure you're doing the right thing, know what you're facing, take a deep breath, steady yourself, be present, be ready. Be sure of yourself. Like that's plenty of Jedi power all by itself.
Yeah, I like that you went that direction with it, because that's where I think I was at in my head too, of and I'm not saying this to deride people that looked at it this way, but it isn't the force points on the back of your card. It isn't your fighting style. It isn't the color of your blade. Those are all fun seasonings in the Jedi soup that we all enjoy. I think it is exactly what you're talking about. We all can do that, and it should translate to our own world and our own life. And none of us here are going to be moving objects with our minds that we know of. Maybe one day we will. Government-funded programs to bend spoons and talk to goats. I get it. But, like, it is exactly what you're saying. This is the Jedi way, because the Jedi way is about being connected to yourself, to the world around you, and that's the power of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any other big picture thoughts before we take a quick break, Jen?
No, I want to meditate though now. I mean, that is the Jedi way, being able to quiet your mind, right?
Yep.
Being able to quiet your mind and just take that moment.
Yep. In the moment, we'll see what comes next. Well, what's coming next for us is we're going to take a quick break. We are recording as the eclipse happens, so maybe we'll start moving things with our minds because of the eclipse. Who knows? We'll find out right after this break. Back in a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And we are back to continue our discussion of the most recent episodes of The Bad Batch, episode 10 and episode 11 of the third season. We talked some of the big ideas. It's also fun to talk all the big canon lore and all that kind of stuff. So as Ken had mentioned, we got some good Project Necromancer details and clarifications. This was one of those episodes where it felt like Hemlock had been maybe getting some social media posts from Star Wars fans. It's like, okay, let me clarify. We had the question of why children? Aren't there plenty of adults who have a high M count? And he's got the kind of ominous, there are few adults left with such characteristics. He goes on to be like, yeah, these kids don't know what it is. They don't know why we're taking their blood. We don't, other than wanting to go home, they don't know what's at stake and why they should resist and all that. Jennifer, how did you feel about that clarification from a storytelling point, from an emotional point of why? Why aren't they just, you know, they've got Jedi to become Inquisitors. Why aren't they taking adult Jedi? Why aren't they using Darth Vader's blood? These are the reasons they're using children. How'd you feel about it?
Oh, it was devastating because there are a lot of adults that believe that kids don't get it. They're like, oh, don't tell the kid, don't fill the kid in on why you're leaving to go to the store, right? Kids know. Kids sense things. Especially in that situation, they're going to know that something is up, right? This is not a camp. Something is up. And so it's just, it was so cruel, and it was very much a real world perspective that I see a lot, where it's like, they don't know, they'll forget, they'll grow up and they'll never remember this stuff. It's like, they do. We see it. You're not paying attention to the behavior. Well, he is paying attention. He doesn't care about the behavior that they're exhibiting.
Mm-hmm.
Oof, what a moment.
Yeah. I was really affected by it. It flashed in my head of, you know, Palpatine's line in Revenge of the Sith, where he seems just a little bit haunted when he says, the Jedi are relentless to Anakin. You know, he's manipulating Anakin, but it's a moment to me of like true fear. He does. Mm-hmm. He talks a big game, but I think Palpatine does fear the Jedi. You know, he's got him in his Inquisitors. He's turned him. He's broken him. There's ones he's not messing with. So he's having him killed by Vader and the Inquisitors. Right. This project is everything to him. It's about his ability to continue. And I like that sort of specter of Palpatine's fear of like, I can't have adult Jedi. Don't find Quinlan Voss and put him there. He'll bleep everything up. I need children, not adult Jedi who might mess with my perfect need to continue myself. Ken, how did you feel about the why children answer?
Yeah, it makes sense on Palpatine's grand scheme. He's someone who always wants to destroy the next generation anyways. It's his, not yours. So it makes sense. And that, yeah, the pain, the kind of haunting ideas put forth here by Hemlock is kind of what you're talking about, Jed. I'm just like, the children will eventually, I don't care what they feel or sense, and eventually they'll adapt. They'll just think this is how they live now. They get to play these games. They're bored, but I don't care. There are specimens. Someone, you know, 15 or older or 10 or old, whatever, they'd want to fight. They'd want to get out. But he's obviously misunderstanding the situation. He's underestimating, like, Jax, for example, tries to escape. Mm-hmm. But in terms of just the Star Wars answers, Joseph, you mentioned earlier, of why in 19 years is the very name of Jedi something in our past? I always go to, you know, I think George in 77 might have intended it, but then the math of two 19-year-old kids, you know, even if you're just looking at Luke and New Hope, the math doesn't add up. But I think it's not just about explaining it. It's about making it make sense in a very real way. You can't even say the Jedi. You can't even say the Force. You have to whisper it. That's the opening scene here. So it all kind of is part of the plan and how this happened. How by the time we meet old Ben Kenobi, it is an ancient, ancient thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's powerful. So we also get some clarity on Force cloning. Hemlock says, as you know, M count cannot be directly replicated from the source. And I think that's just the first most clear answer of like, yeah, Palpatine can't just straight up clone himself and go, oh, same amount of midichlorians. Yeah. And I think there's this attempt to like, well, let's make another CP52 and like, okay, well, they don't have the same M count. It degrades. We've heard that before, that the M count degrades.
Right.
So now we've got this clarity. Hemlock goes on to say, however, Nala Se knew of another way, which is why she aided in Omega's escape. The young clone's blood is the only binder that's proven to be compatible with their DNA to recreate their M count levels. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, how do you feel about that clarity of Omega's blood makes it possible to basically make a clone and of somebody with high M count and not have the M count degrade if you mix in a little bit of Omega's blood as a binder.
I thought it was very helpful for somebody that struggles with science. I was like, please spell it out for me. Give me a chart. Hemlock, pull down the projector. Let's go through this, because I was wondering myself. I'm like, oh man, how does that work? So
show it to me like a trench run with 70s graphics.
That's what I need. A visual learner. So yeah, I appreciated that. Yeah. That clarification. Yeah.
Ken, how did you feel about it?
It all makes sense. And I'm like you, Jen. I needed Hemlock to be like, all right, let me pull down my flow chart here and show you what's going on. I think I've always taken it this way from the beginning of just like, no, you can't just simply, You know, you don't have a bunch of Palpatines. That's why it didn't work. That's why you had a forceless son, you know, like you're a waste to me. It also speaks, I think, to even with, you know, we're talking about clones, but going back to Yoda in the beginning of the Clone Wars series of you're clones, but you have your own identity. So it's like you can't just, you know, you can't just make a Palpatine because, you know, that person, that body, that blood has its own identity, its own purpose, its own connection with the Force or the galaxy. And so I like it. It all makes sense to me as far as I can understand in my limited brain power. And that the binding, I wrote that down too, of the midichlorians can stick to her in a way is how I kind of look at it.
Yeah, I like just the clarity of the science, and I think we're probably going to get even more as Project Necromancer, I think, is Delta's setback probably in this final season of Bad Batch. But it also just made me think of ideas about the Force and cloning. We talk a lot about that scene in Ambush, the first Clone Wars episode of Yoda saying they're all unique in the Force. And but I hadn't really stopped to really think about how Star Wars is sort of playing with these very old science fiction ideas. People credit Mary Shelley's Frankenstein as being one of the originals, if not the original science fiction book. And that is dealing with the merging of science and nature. Can you recreate life? And what is the responsibility if you do? Can humans play, creator? All this stuff about them having a hard time just making another exact copy of something just made me feel like the Force is sort of, even with all the science, the Force is just always insisting that everybody is unique, an individual. Like, you cannot just make an exact copy of someone. They're going to be a little different because the Force values the organic and the flowing and the different. That's kind of where some of my mind went with the philosophy of it as well. So I'm interested to see how much more they deal with that.
Absolutely. I like that.
We talked a little bit about Cad Bane. So I just want to check in if there's any other thoughts. I thought it was really different to see him again after spending more time with him in Book of Boba Fett, knowing his end. People had some funny memes. I believe it was our friend Brian Ward who shared the screen capture of Cad Bane's end going, you know, really excited for this to happen to Cad Bane. Ken, did you have any other Cad Bane thoughts?
I really like the use of him, and I think I think other people were expecting quote unquote more of him this season because he shows up in the trailer. You got Fennec Shan. There's a thought we're going to spend a lot of time in the underworld. I think if this is all we get, it makes perfect sense. It's one of those things of who would be doing this at this point in the storyline. Who's alive? Who's around? Who would be a class one bounty hunter? It's this guy we've seen before, and then we can, you know, break it down like we did earlier. So I think this is the purpose of Cad Bane in this show, in the series, much like Ventress, in and out. Fennec Shan, in and out. It's great use of these characters, tying them to the story, and then we go focus on who we need to focus on in this series.
Yeah, absolutely. Jennifer, any other Cad Bane thoughts?
It just adds a little bit of depth to that scene to see somebody that we character that we already know, right? Mm-hmm. We know his history. We know his end. So I really liked how they used him. And I agree. If this is it, I'm fine with it. It was just the right amount. But it was, because I was like, what if it was some random bounty hunter? It wouldn't have the same kind of heft to the scene. I really liked that they used him.
Yeah, me too. And it just really, our talk is really making me remember, like, what a badass he is in the Clone Wars and how sad and pathetic his role in this is. And kind of a reminder that, like, the bad guys are cool. They look cool. They sound cool. But, like, what a sad being Cad Bane is, ultimately, you know?
I wouldn't have minded if it was Dengar, though. And he shows up and he's like, if I miss this one, I'm going to be a class two. I told Mrs. Dengar, I got to get it. I got to get it.
The bunny mom kicked my ass. I got demoted to a class 7 bounty hunter. So how did you guys feel about the presence in the ongoing question of the identity of CX2? For me, I kind of every time he appears and we don't get that helmet off, we don't get the identity. It ratchets up that tension and that question. I haven't spent a lot of time on social media. I'm sure people are buzzing about this, but the fact that he broke Fee's encryption, I'm sure is fueling some, maybe he's a tech clone or, you know, in a brainwashed, you know, surviving version of tech. It looked like Hemlock was examining more Clone X troops. And after that Tarkin threat, he tabs over to another design and he tells CX2 explicitly, the other operatives aren't ready to join you in the field. So we got the ongoing question of CX2's identity. And we also feel like it feels like around the corner, it feels like Hemlock's got his next model of whatever the CX. I mean, the CX clones that we've met so far were just brainwashed clones. But it seems like there's something different with this one. Ken, how are you feeling about all that CX2 intrigue and more clone troopers from Hemlock?
Yeah, even as you're speaking, I'm like, oh, there's no way it's tech. Oh, it's definitely tech, but could be Cody. No, Cody walked away, and that was such a powerful moment. Nah, I don't think about that. I don't know. It's and that's the fun of it, and that's fun. I think I accidentally wore our old Speculate Responsibly T-shirt today because I think I want to try to be responsible to myself. God, even with the tech goggles today, I took the tech goggles thing as like a, hey, he's gone. Right. He's gone.
Right. Right.
Like, let's all acknowledge it. And he's gone. And I still think in the end of the day, that might be the answer I'd like. But then even going back to stuff you were talking about in the off season, Joseph, about how horribly painful it would be to be a tech 2.0. That's not quite him, especially now if this is what he's doing and he doesn't even know what he's doing. Or maybe, you know, it's not him. So it's not him directly. So there's a faint feeling of I know these people, but now they're just targets to me. I don't know. The Cody thing, I know it was out there for a while. It doesn't make as much sense to me as this goes on. But as you said, the tension being ratcheted up, I was like, oh, this might hurt. This might hurt.
Yeah. Jennifer, how are you feeling about the CX2 identity mystery?
I figured it was tech until this episode with the goggles. The same thing. I'm like, they're telling us fans, no, he's dead. Put his arrest. Yeah. Right? But then I was like, but it just makes sense. And it's going to be a great reveal. But now I'm getting impatient where I'm like, let's just get this reveal over with. I want to know who it is or what.
Yeah, I think that's the you know, we've talked about this before. It's a great part of being a fan. The fun of speculating. But we can overdo it. And, you know, the internet has, you know, ongoing jokes about, you know, Mephisto, because every time it's a mystery of who the bad guy is in MCU, people are sure Mephisto's coming. There's a joke in Doctor Who communities of it's not Susan, because it's a character featured in the very beginning of Doctor Who. And every time there's a mystery woman that you don't know who it is, everybody's like, is it Susan? So, I mean, it's a thing that goes across fandom where it's fun to speculate, but then we become obsessive about those answers. And it's almost, we've been talking about the way, like, hey, Fennec was in the trailer, Cad Bane was in the trailer, Asajj was in the trailer, but we didn't get any answers about Asajj's resurrection. And like, the show never promised us those things.
Yeah.
The show is building up and promising us something with CX2, I think, by spending this long and this much focus on the character. And I think that's what's ratcheting up the tension for me of like, it's one thing if we, the fans, make an assumption. We saw a shot in a trailer, so we assume a whole storyline that the creators never intended. That's on us, in my opinion. The creators are putting CX2 in front of us and not taking off that damn helmet. Yeah. It's making it feel like I really do hope there's something emotionally, powerfully resonant about the reveal.
Yeah. Tech 2.0. Cross her.
Cross her. Oh my God.
Tech hair. I think it is a possibility that he is a mingled clone of the Bad Batch. I also do think it's a possibility that he is not that Tech survived that fall, but they took Tech's DNA off those broken goggles, and that's another narrative point of them.
Yep.
And that they made a Tech with the same skills. And trained him up. And that to me, I think I'm interested in, because I think it could have emotionally resonant power for Omega to be like, do you know where you come from? Like, you're your own person. You don't have the life experiences that Tech did, but do you want to know what that person, what your progenitor chose to do with his abilities? Do you want to live up to that? There's an angle in there to something emotional, you know, other than just being painful, but for an argument of evolution and change.
Yeah, it's a great tech still has a great, wonderful why. Wonderful being painful. And you know, I think we're all three in the same boat. But like, yeah, even out in the wild, if you approach me at a bar with a great theory about Star Wars, I need to know the why. Otherwise, I bluntly just don't care. I'll figure it out. I'll find out when they want us to know. And there's a big dangling why.
There's a big dangling why. Last bit of canon I have is this was a triumph for background weirdos. There it was the bunny guy who turns out his name is Wamuth in Solo. There the little bunny guy who congratulates Solo when he thinks he's won the Sabacc game. And for quite a while, he was a background weirdo that didn't have a name yet. And he stood out to some of us. We're like, we like that bunny guy. And we like knowing the weirdo Star Wars names. And I remember even with trivia, that, you know, when a bunch of us were doing the Schmodown before it was released, people were like, I can't find the name of the bunny guy. turns out his name, I think, was in, I can't remember what, like Fascinating Facts or something. Wamuth. But this is a triumph for background weirdos that the mother and the poor abducted child and the toy, their species is a Tarlafars. Her name is Ailish. His name is Bairn. You know, a lot of times they would just use, like, these could have been Athorians. They got the models, you know? But it was a great connective tissue to be like, hey, you all like that one design in Solo. We'll take the time to build new models and have this additional emotional connection for us kind of really in the bubble. Because as soon as it started, it's like, wow, this is so deep. We're getting to see the tragedy. Oh, the toy thing is affecting me. Oh, those are the bunny guys. It had an emotional resonance for me. Jennifer, how do you feel about this bunny family?
Well, that makes sense because I was like, why do these look familiar? That's why. Okay. So, I'm so behind on my creatures and species. But I just loved it. It was such a great detail. And as I said, I love the noises that were very specific and Grogu-like. Great. I want a little stuffed plush of that character.
Yeah. And it's just effective that they do look like little bunny people with 4 ears and really cute and lovely. Ken, how did you feel about the triumph of the bunny people?
Again, as I said up top, I knew the Solo connection, but like it was the perfect species to break my heart because it's just a cute, cuddly bunny / pet dog cat kind of kitten kind of vibe. And I was in my feels about having to leave my dogs and Grace too. Don't worry, but leave my dogs for 5 days. And it was a perfect choice. And we love that movie. I love that movie so much. Solo, Star Wars Story. So anytime it gets represented on screen, a little smile on my soul.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about favorite moments. These episodes were just full of comedy. No, they were not. But Ken, what were some favorite moments? Be they action, whimsy, heartbreaking, just a great shot.
Yeah. There was the great shots were all there. I think that in the heartbreak, but even the Marauder exploding and just like, you know, CX, was he two or three? He's CX2.
I believe he's CX2 is what I thought I had found this morning on old Wikipedia.
When he launches the little grenades on there, everything about it, the sound design, the realization on Wrecker's face, loved all that. The Empire, I mentioned earlier, but the Empire showing up and just the way, you know, I think it's Crosshair. It's like, we've been compromised. They don't have time to react. They're already here. The Empire's already here. It's such a Star Wars-y shot, a Star Destroyer over a city or over a planet. But it's always got great purpose to me, even as we've broken down before. The Imperial March is an oppressive march over the galaxy. That is the design behind it. So I love little moments like that. And just in terms of the first episode, it's such a sad ballad of an episode, right? It's this wonderful piece of moody art. Just the time they took with Emery and pushing in on her face and her glasses, even having I think Ava said, I like your glasses. Like, it's just every detail about Emery and the time that they took to get this all kind of working in her soul was favorite stuff for me.
Yeah, great stuff. Jennifer, favorite moments?
The music in the first of the two episodes was so great. Having been through a lot of royalty-free music over the weekend, you're looking for certain key words. And it's specifically when you're dealing with like children or youth, there's like a, you'll actually say like child or children in the description. And immediately when I heard the music, I'm like, oh, I can tell there's like this little thing. And I, if I were listening to it again, I would know the instrument. Right. But there's just something like there's this childlike theme that's woven, but it's haunting. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my gosh. And then you combine that with Emery. And there was a moment, I think when she gives the doll to Eva and her shoulders, she's like, sighs. Mm-hmm. It was such a small detail, but I'm like, gosh, these people are incredible. Like you're saying, Ken, taking that time, every little detail, just really making this character feel so real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a ton of great moments like that. One of the shots that I loved is when Jax tries to escape and he slips on the floor. I mean, I kind of had a flashback to like growing up with some of the like super cheap like Filmation. You know, like E-Man in the 80s, we're like, we need to reuse every shot. We only have, we have one bit of film where He-Man rolls and we're going to use it every episode, to this level of animation where that detail of him slipping so believably, where you could feel those cold, hard, polished floors, and like moment that like totally like doesn't need to be there, but enhances it and makes it feel so real. I love that moment.
Mm-hmm. And the animation team, the directors, the people putting them together, you know, deserve high praise. We try to give it to them every episode we do this. And I, you know, just because, you know, on a live set, you got an actor making a choice. You got to, hey, let's try this instead. Let's try this take. And here there's a little more planning involved. So to build in those little moments, those very realistic moments, it's takes a lot of foresight and skill, and they got it.
Yeah, find those. Yeah. We talked about the opening with the kid, you know, being hunted for being gifted. Mm-hmm. But I really like that line. People say he's cursed and then, you know, gifted. Mm-hmm. It's really ominous, but it's also like that line, that exact choice of dialogue, you know, it could have just been more flat of like, that kid might be a Jedi or whatever. It just really drove home the like that it's cursed, that you're cursed to be gifted in this era. Mm-hmm. That if you have any power, it belongs to Palpatine, and it's dangerous to have power. It's dangerous to be yourself. I thought that was really put across by he's cursed, gifted, was really powerful. Couple of kind of more actual fun moments there from Fee. I didn't really notice him the first time around because I was too busy watching CX2 Tech Hair, whoever he is, get on her ship. But she's having that fun banter with her droid, and she says, "Who cares if your panels don't match? Patchy bodywork shows grit." It's just a funny thing to say to a droid, and it also feels like a million conversations I've with people about why the original trilogy design is good. It's like it's gritty when it looks real and lived in. Like Fee saying, "Like you got that original trilogy look, ML221."
That's funny. Yeah.
Other moment of just little tiny bit of whimsy that was there in the second episode is when the ship is flying all wonky and Omega says, "Crosshair, is that Hunter?" And Crosshair says, "Uh-huh." I'll cling to any little bit of whimsy in those episodes.
Yes. Yes.
Any other moments that either you would like to share before we move on?
No. I think we covered all. I at one point stop even marking down moments because I was pulled in by the darkness. Toto's an interesting character. I'd love to go into the archives and figure out why they were like, hey, we got this big bad bounty hunter who shows up to the public with the kidnapping episode first. The actual canonical order, he's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. It shows up earlier, but we all met him when he's doing some horrific things in the Clone Wars. Let's give him just the wise-assiest of droids.
So funny.
Toto's interesting choice to be.
Dopey little weirdo. And maybe Cad Bane is going to, you know, appear again so Toto can complete his emotional arc. all the action stuff with Hunter was great, too. It's sad that it didn't work out, but a lot of cool moves there. Was there anything, Jennifer, in these two episodes that you disliked or questioned or struggled with in any way?
No, I mean, I like we talked about, I kind of predicted where the episode was headed, you know, but that's to be expected because obviously we talk about this every week and, you know, we're just were also, I figured that this was kind of a moment that was, I don't want to say telegraphed for the younger audience, but yeah, it just, it is what it is. I'm fine with it.
Yeah. I think that too, I think that's sort of the nature of the beast of being in the bubble and really loving this show and being in a community where we're going to, if you're not going to do it personally, someone else is going to freeze frame every part of the trailer. And like, exactly. There's a part of me is like, well, they shouldn't have put in anything at Pablo. And like, then there's a part of me is like, let's take a step back. Yeah. This is also for general audiences that are not going to pause every scene to look for Pabu. And I'm not judging anyone. We all process it in different ways, but I also like, I want to be careful not to, they have to walk the line of, we need some exciting shots in the trailer. We need to make this for a general audience, not just for the freeze framers out there. We knew this was coming, but I'm not going to ding them for that. Ken?
Yeah, no, didn't dislike any of that for the reasons you both listed. I remember the story I told of being at a Walgreens and I put down a Chewbacca with a Porg Funko. And the guy was like, I love Star Wars. And he said, what's that bird? I said, it's the Porg from Last Jedi, the new Star Wars. And he went, they made new Star Wars films? Like,
that's impressive.
It was impressive. Wow. 100% true story, too. But so, I knew what was coming too, or at least we knew we were getting here. And that's just us. That's just us in the circle. Cause it's fun. I did some freeze framing on the other trailer we're going to break down on the episode, the episodes this week. It's part of the fun. But so nothing against the show. Yeah, no, I love it. I don't question it, but this is a really darker season, right? The tones are so somber and real and powerful. And I think it's a brave decision. I'm not questioning it. I hope we get some happy, hopeful resolution in a bigger, darker era, which is the age of the Empire. It's the only thing I'm looking forward to in the last four episodes.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the clones are not going to topple the Empire, but I am looking forward to some sort of emotional victories for the Bad Batch and for the clones in general. And the way I'm feeling about it is like, yeah, we knew this was going back to Tantiss. And a part of that is, like, you know, I love thinking about storytelling like music, where even if you're not particularly musically inclined and you don't know the note, but you can hear and humans hear and feel resolution. You can hear the note that brings you home and resolves the song. And we sense it when something doesn't resolve. And to me, this is like, it's a very musical show. Mm-hmm. Tantiss is the note that's going to resolve this. And I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. We always try to end with a fun question. If we could have a figure or merch of any character or idea or anything from this episode, who or what do we want? How many toys do we want? Ken, what do you want?
I want with a gentle giant kind of figure, a sculpture. I want a Wrecker grabbing Gonky stuff. Like forever frozen.
That's good.
I was imagining, a gentle giant statue of Crosshair firing, and then there's like a little invisible piece of plastic that shows the thing on this downward arc.
Oh, no.
Awful. I just actually Googled, like, wait a minute, the actual original Lula doll, did they ever make that? And I Googled it, and like Disney stores were selling it, but it sold out. Yeah. So that's what I want. I want Lula back in stock, Dan.
There you go.
Jennifer, how about you?
I want the bunny mama and kid because I've mentioned I have a Monchichi with her baby. I want that, my Star Wars version of that.
Yeah.
Great. One of the stuffed animals I had till I was in sixth grade was a little raccoon with its arms around a little raccoon baby. So we can all add that to the connection.
So cute.
So lovely. Give us the bunnies. Give us the bunnies we demand, the Tarlafars.
Okay.
Hashtag give us the Tarlafars. There we go. All right. That is our big look at these episodes of Bad Batch. We'll be back on our normal schedule in a couple of days talking about the upcoming episode of Bad Batch this coming Wednesday. That episode will be out later in the day. Ken, we want to let people know where they can find us.
I do. And thank you to all who allowed us the time to get these episodes out. We appreciate your patience on that. And I want to say this, too. Could I go a little curveball here? I want to shout out. I just saw before we set the record, James Bainey, the Resistance Broadcast, has announced that he's leaving the Resistance Broadcast after 7 years to spend time with his family and do other things. And John and Lacey are going to continue the Resistance Broadcast. Fine folks. Wish them luck as they move on to a new era. But tip of the cap to James. He's a great guy. We had a lot where he watched me eat one day at a Burbank restaurant because he was swinging by the Jedi Council set. Wonderful human. James, tip of the cap to your work over the last 7 years over there. We're the Force Center Podcast or the Force Center Show. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Hive, Dog Barks. You can find us all at there at Force Center Pod. We're on Facebook as Force Center Podcast. Subscribe on the YouTube channel, please, if you will, if you want, and share us there. Don't forget, you can get merch like the Speculate Responsibly t-shirt that's still there at tpublic.com/user/ForceCenter. You can support us directly at patreon.com/ForceCenter. You can follow us on our own individual pursuits. Follow me at Ken Napsok or KenNapsok.com. I have updated information soon on more shows. Shout out to Elias and Chris and David, some Force Center friends who were out at the show in Boston at the Rockwell with me and Mark Ellis on Saturday. It's great to meet you, shake hands, and talk for a moment. I appreciate that. All the information for future shows on my website. Jen, where can they find you?
You can find me and my dog, Mala, on all the social media sites at Jennifer Landa or TikTok at Jennifer Landa 1138.
There you go, Joseph. Wonderful stuff. We've all been exhausted. We've all been traveling, but you planted your feet on the ground and got us through here today. Appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. And you always have amazing insights, both of you, no matter how many little theme ideas I write down. I always get to learn and think about it in new and different ways. So thank you both. And thank you for everyone who leaves comments and shares your thoughts. It's really fun to hear all the different ways to process these episodes. For myself personally, you can find me on all the different social media at Joseph Scrimshaw is my handle everywhere. If you want to keep up with some of my film adventures, you can check my website. It's just josephscrimshaw.com. There are more screenings coming up for The Nightmare Adorable. Don't have the information up yet, but it is going to be screening at a big convention in Seattle, Crypticon, the first weekend of May. I think I'm probably going to be going to that one. We'll see how I managed to go to Seattle and see The Phantom Menace, but I'm going to figure it out. Other thing I want to mention real quick, as the election season begins to heat up for several months, I am working on writing some letters with a group called Vote Forward. Their website is votefwd.org. And what it is you just write a short message about why you think voting is important. You send it to different voters, and it has been proven, they followed up, that it increases voter turnout. And for me, it's a little concrete thing that I can do to encourage people to use their power. That is it. We have had the Bad Batch Report.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.